Thank you, Rusty. Dr. Weidemeyer. As he said, we go back a long ways. And he asked me to share my testimony with you. He asked me that last month, and I did a little bit of praying about that. And I thought, what would the Lord want me to share specifically with you? And I thought, as I began to think back over the course of my life, I thought about all of the miracles that God has performed in my life. I don't know whether you've ever taken inventory of your own lives and looked at it from that perspective. But when you sit down and you start to reflect about what God has done, it's pretty breathtaking. When you think about some of the characters in both the Old Testament and the New Testament, you realize that sometimes in their lives, we read about the fact that God only intervened maybe once or twice or three times in their entire lives. And other figures in the Old Testament, like Moses, for example, it was almost a constant intervention there in his life and how he was the leader of the nation of Israel. So I thought I would just take a trip tonight back through my life and talk about the miracles that God has performed in my life. Definition of the miracle is right up there on the board. So going back in time, in 1952, I was 4 years old, and I was walking down the street in a trailer court where we lived, which was located right on the site that Disney World is located on right now in California. So I'm dating myself. And I was walking down the road there, minding my own business, eating a popsicle. And lo and behold, out of nowhere, comes this full-size collie, jumps the fence, and comes over and starts munching on me. Bit me several times, once right in the face, right up here. And I was very fortunate. All that actually came out of that was lots of bruises, one puncture wound right here. And I went on after that. So that was 1952. 1955, we moved back to Ohio. And it was at that point in time that I started attending here in Mansfield, St. John's United Church of Christ. You might know where that's at. That's down near the square there in Mansfield. That church has been in existence a long time. And in that particular church, I learned one thing. I learned about God. I learned about God. In 1963, another miracle occurred in my life. There were three of us that were selected to perform in the senior band at Madison High School as freshmen. That normally didn't happen. You had to go into junior high band, and there were three of us that got into that. Now, why God put me in that situation, I don't know, but that was a pretty amazing thing. It was a supernatural event to me. In 1969, I met my wife while working at Kroger's. She's smiling. She was a cashier. I worked in the produce department. So the joke was that we met over the lettuce. Because she was a hot tomato, huh? In 1972, we got married. I don't know whether you've ever thought about marriage as being a miracle or not, but it is an intervention by God in the lives of two people. And that intervention creates two people that become one from that point in time forward. So that's a miracle. 1971 and 1972, I got a teaching job that school year, 71-72, at Lexington. And I, unfortunately, was one of those guys that graduated in 1971, and the teaching profession was just overflowing with teachers. And I worked at Kroger's down on Lexington Avenue all the time I was going through college. And so I tried to get a teaching job, and I couldn't find one. So I just continued working at Kroger's. And then this must have been about October of that year. A person from the News Journal called me up one night at home and said, "We're doing an interview on teachers that are unable to find jobs. Would you be interested?" I said, "Well, what's involved?" And they said, "Well, We'd like to come to your current place of employment, wherever that is, and do an interview with you and so on and so forth. I said, that's fine. So a couple days later, they came to the Kroger store, and I was working that morning. They did the interview, and they said, oh, we want to get a couple pictures, by the way. So they took a picture of me carrying out a bag of groceries, even though I wasn't the guy that carried out the groceries. Yeah. And a few days later, that picture appeared on the cover of the Mansfield News Journal. And two days later after that, I got a call from the superintendent of Lexington Local Schools that says, we have an opening that just came open, and we're looking for a person that has your credentials that can step right in and take over these classes. What he didn't tell me was that the students had ran the teacher out. ran the teacher out. She had a master's degree in education. And after about 4 weeks, she said, I can't take it anymore, and she left. And so I, being, you know, young and unknowing, stepped into that situation. And it was a tremendous struggle to right the ship, so to speak. I thought I was going to get punched out a couple times, because I had the last class of the day was, I taught biology, enriched and regular biology. The last class of the day was all the athletes. They stuck them all in the last class of the day. And there was, I think, about 21 guys in there and two girls. And they always went out of their way to create problems. And at Lexington, at that particular point in time, the classrooms were in a satellite setting, so the teachers went from building to building. So you can imagine what would happen between classes, between the time the last teacher left and the next teacher came on the scene. And we had a lot of challenges there, but it all came down to the final time there, just before Christmas break. We had an assembly, and everybody dismissed early. Well, you know, in the school system, that what is done in period one, that news makes its way all the way up through the grades. By the time the end of the day got there, this class was expecting to go home without any homework. And I made sure that they went home with homework, that they were the only class that I had that had that responsibility over the holidays. So when the bell rang for the assembly to begin, all these guys got up out of their seats, came up around my desk. These big guys that played football. And all of them had tears in their eyes, and they were really upset. I said, well, guys, I said, you brought this on yourself. I said, we can do one of two things. I said, you can buckle down and do what I ask you to do in the classroom, stop horsing around, or we can make this a continual fight until the end of the year. So I said, the choice is yours. I'm going to expect you to come back with your homework completed. And they looked at me. They all turned around on their heels and walked out. And when we came back from Christmas vacation, everything was wonderful. I never had any more problems with that group after that. One of the best classes. Actually, went from being the worst class to the best class. So that was 71 and 72. 74 was a milestone in my life, because that's when I met Jesus. In the educational system, you know, teachers go into the teacher's lounge and they talk about two things. Number one, the days are going to get off. And number two, the students that are causing them trouble. Every once in a while, they get around to things that are really important. And I can remember at that point in time, all the talk was about a book called The Late Great Planet Earth. Anybody remember that book? Hal Lindsey wrote it? And that was the talk of what was going on, so I thought, may I get a copy of that book and read through it so I can at least act educated when I talk to them. And so I did that. And over the course of the next couple of months, God began convicting me about what I read, and I gave my life to Christ at the end of that book, just like He asked you to do. You know, He gives the invitation at the end of the book, and I gave my life to Jesus at that point in time. And about 2 weeks later, guess who calls me up? This guy back here in the back row. He says, hey, I got something I want to share with you. Can I come over? I said, sure. So he came over and he shared with me about how he had come to know Jesus shortly before that. So we rejoiced together at that particular point in time, just a few weeks apart, that these events happened, you know, in our lives. So after that, in 1976, my next miracle was my first son was born, Derek. Kids are always miracles. They fit the description. It's a supernatural event. 1977, another miracle happened. I came from what I would call a somewhat religious background, but my parents weren't religious per se, but they made sure I was religious. I can remember my dad taking me down to St. John's Church and dropping me off for Sunday school and then leaving and going and visiting his friends. So after I came to know the Lord, I started praying for my parents, and in 1977, God answered that prayer. They went to a Billy Graham crusade in Cleveland, and both of them were saved in 1977. Also in 77 was a big year because that's when Dr. Weidemeyer and I and Barb and Vicki went around and toured all the chiropractic colleges that we thought we'd be interested in going to. And we felt that God wanted us to go to Logan College. And so that's where we went. So that was 1977. We also made some decisions in that particular year concerning finances and how we were going to live while we're down there. We knew that our wives would have to go to school or have to go to work to support us while we're in school, which they were glad to do. But we found a place down there, a mobile home park, to put mobile homes in. And so we bought some mobile homes and put them in this park. And this park was way out in the middle of nowhere. And it was 5 miles from the closest little city, which was Wentzville. It was about 21 or 22 miles west of St. Louis. And we didn't know exactly why we were in that mobile home park, but we were satisfied with it. So we did that. In 1977, I also sold my home in Lexington. I should say our home in Lexington. And that was one of the criteria that I used to see if God wanted me to actually go to chiropractic college. You've heard about testing the fleece. You know, Gideon and his story of testing the fleece. Well, I tested the fleece. I said, Lord, if you want me to go, then let's see you sell this house. So I thought, let's not enlist a realtor. Let's really make it difficult. Let's see you sell it. I'll just try to sell it myself. So on Friday night, I put my sign in the yard, for sale by owner. At that point in time, my wife and I were doing a lot of boating, so we'd leave a lot of times for Saturdays and Sundays and come back in the evening. Came back Sunday evening and there was a message on the answering machine. We were driving past your house today. We're from Cleveland. And it looks like the kind of house that we would like to buy, but we'd like to take a look at it. When's the soonest we can come and look at it? And so I called him back and I said, you know, as soon as you want to come, it's fine. They said, well, how about Tuesday night? I said, that's great. The next morning was Monday morning and this gal came by who had also seen the house and she said, I really like your house. She said, I'd like to buy it, but. And I said, well, what's the but? She says, I have to sell my house first. Well, this was in June of 77, and I was ready to go to chiropractic college in August, so I couldn't wait for her to sell her house. So I said, I'll keep you in mind. And I says, why don't you try to sell your house? I said, if I still have mine, when you sell yours, I'll be glad to, you know, work out a deal with you. Tuesday night rolls around. This other couple comes from Cleveland. They walk through the house. They said, this is exactly what we want. No haggle on the price or anything. We said, we'll take it. Just like that. So I said, well, Lord, you answered that question in short order. So we sold the house in that summer of 77. It was about June. Went to chiropractic college. Got set up down there. I took a course in the fall of that year from August through December. I was short one course in organic chemistry, so I needed to take that. So I took that down there, and then all of us got there and started in January of 78. June of 78, we had another miracle. Our oldest daughter was born, Tiffany. That was June of 78. So here we are. We're down there in St. Louis going to school. And Laura and April were kind enough to babysit my children because the way chiropractic college works is you go to school in the morning, get there about 7:30, 8, and you're in class from 8 till about 3, 3:30 or 4, And then after 4 is the time you do all your labs. So if you do an anatomy lab, for example, from 4 till however late you want to stay, then you go home after that, you do all your studying, and then you start all over the next day. That's just the way it runs, and it runs year-round. You're off 3 weeks in the summer, and that's it. It's full-time year-round. So Tiffany was born then. We didn't know exactly how that situation was going to work out because Tiffany was born with Down's syndrome. And I don't know if you know anything about Down's children or not, but they take a lot of time and a lot of effort. And she was sick. She was born with a congenital heart defect. And at that particular point in time, I can remember getting the phone call from Vicki because I was in school when Tiffany was born. And I couldn't get to the hospital by the time she was born, but I got down there after she was born. That must have been about 5 or 6 at night when I was there. And the doctors came in and they didn't say anything about the situation at that particular point in time. So we assumed everything was okay. So I went home, and then that night about 10:30, she called me and said there's something wrong with Tiffany. So I got in the car and went back down to the hospital, and then they proceeded to tell us that she had Down syndrome. And they said she's probably got about 3 weeks to live. And the next question was, do you want to take her home or do you want to leave her here? And I don't know whether you understand that or not, but at that point in time, when you had kids with birth defects, you could leave them at the hospital if you wanted to. We said, no, we're taking her home. She's part of our family. So we took her home with the idea that she had 3 weeks to live. And I thought, well, I'm in chiropractic college. Maybe I should get as much help as I can get from the professors at the school. And they said, well, they said you have to realize a couple things. Number one, when you have a Down's child in the United States, it's completely different than when you have a Down's child in Europe. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, because in Europe, medical doctors and chiropractors and osteopaths all work together, and they have the benefit of the patient as their highest priority. In the United States, it's always a struggle between medicine and chiropractic and osteopathy and all the other disciplines. But they said, the best thing you can do is get Tiffany off all the medication they've got her on and get her on the nutrition to take its place. So they told me what to do. And she was on Lanoxin, which is rat poison, from the hospital. And so we worked her off of Lanoxin and we got her on all the nutrition. And then Vicki would take her back down for her checkups. And she went down at 3 weeks, and they were amazed how well she was doing. Well, she's going to probably live to be 6 months old now, or 3 months old. And it just kept going on and on and on and on. They kept extending the times. And when we left down there, they said, well, we don't know how long she's going to live, but she's going to live quite a while. So when we left down there and moved back, Tiffany was all on natural nutrition. 1979, I had another miracle. My wife was coming home from work, and late at night, early in the morning, and rolled our car over. That was a miracle. She didn't get hurt. Smashed the car all up, ended up on it. She didn't feel like a miracle. Car landed on its side up against a barbed wire fence, and she had to crawl out the top door. So I thought that was pretty cool. 1980. Here we are. We're getting ready to leave St. Louis. You remember a while back I said how God kind of directed us out to this mobile home park? And we put our mobile homes in this park. About 6 months before we got ready to move, guess what happened? General Motors makes this announcement. They said, we're going to build a brand new plant in Wentzville, which was 5 miles from where our mobile home park was at. As soon as they made that announcement, that park started filling up just like crazy. So both Rusty and I were able to turn our units over and I got all my money back and some plus that. So God was intervening there for us financially at that particular point in time because we were actually lived there for free. Other than what we paid for the lot rent and utilities. So that's a pretty amazing thing when you think about, we talk about trusting God in every avenue of our life. We say, well, Lord, I think I can handle the finances. You handle the other stuff. But that's not true. You have to turn all of these things over and then just let Him do the work. Then I got out of chiropractic college in 1980. Officially, we graduated in 81, January of 81. So we started looking for a place to practice. And it was interesting that when we were in chiropractic college down there in the last 6 months, before we went down, I don't think any one of us had any idea where we're going to go to practice. Because once you go to a professional school, you get licensed, you take the state board exam in whatever state you want to practice, you know, the sky's the limit. If you want to go to California or Florida or wherever you want to go, you can do it. So that was open for us. And then in the last 6 months, we started actually looking at the scope of practice. In other words, what can you do with your chiropractic license in a given state? And it varies from state to state. For example, when we graduated, you could use acupuncture, needle acupuncture, in the state of Illinois, but you couldn't do it in the state of Ohio. In the state of Ohio, you could draw blood. You couldn't do that in other states. So we started looking at the scope of practice in all the states, and we actually narrowed it down, I think, to about four states. Ohio was one, Florida was one, North Carolina was one, I think California might have been the fourth one. And then we tried to decide, well, Lord, where do you want us to go? And after a while of praying about it and talking about it, we decided, you know, that we probably should go back to Ohio. You've heard those things called roots. Yeah, they bring you back. So we came back to Ohio, and I felt that I was looking to start into practice by assuming somebody else's practice. That's how I looked at it. So while I was still down in chiropractic college, there was a notice on the bulletin board down there where doctors send in descriptions of their practices, and when they're getting ready to retire or sell, you know, you get to see that information. Well, I saw this one up in Findlay. This was like 6 months before I graduated. I thought, by the time I get out, it'll be gone for sure. So when I got out of chiropractic college, the practice was still available. So I called the doctor, and I went up there. See, we graduated in January, but we had to wait till February to take our state licensure exam. Couldn't practice before that. And so between January and February, in that time frame, I wanted to see if I could get something going to where I'd go to practice. So I went up there and talked to this doctor. Well, I don't know if you recall what happened in 1980, 81 or not, but the interest rates just went off the map. I mean, 16, 17, 18% for a conventional loan. And for guys that are coming out of school that are completely broke, how appealing are you going to be to a bank? You know, you have debt coming out of school, and you know, you've got to come up with some kind of down payment. So I went up to Findlay, talked to this doctor, and he said, well, he said, just apply to the banks around here. So I applied to four of the banks, the four major banks in Findlay. Two of them had the kindness and respect to answer me and said, no, we can't give you the money. The other two didn't even bother answering me. So I told him, I said, well, I said, doc, I said, I don't think I'm going to be able to do this. I said, because I can't get a loan. So he called me back a couple days later, and he says, I'll tell you what. He says, I will underwrite the whole thing myself. And he said, instead of you paying the bank, he says, I'll loan you the money per se. I'll give you the practice. You just make the payments to me. Is that a miracle? It sure is. So that's what I did. I purchased this practice in 1981. And the former doctor, Dr. Herdman, was the doctor that was there. He'd practiced there 14 years before I came. And we practiced together for 3 months, and then he retired from the practice, and then he went to seminary. They have a Weinbrenner Seminary up there, and he went to the seminary. And I continued practicing. In 1985, my second son was born, Micah. 1987, second daughter, Leah, was born. 1987, I decided the place we lived there in Findlay was right on Main Street, and I had a separate home and a separate office complex all in the same lot. No garage or anything, no place to put anything. So I thought, well, I've made enough money now, I can find a spot and build a garage. So I rode my bicycle. I can remember this, riding my bicycle all around the office, kind of in a concentric circles, larger and larger and larger, to see what I could find. And I found this lot about three or four blocks from my office on a side street. And I checked into it, and the guy that owned the lot, the vacant lot, he lived right next door, and he said, yeah, he said, I would be interested in selling it. So I said, okay, we arrived at a price. And so then I went downtown to the city zoning department, and I talked to the zoning inspector, and I said, you know, I'd like to purchase this lot here. He pulled up the plat. I said, I want to purchase this lot here, and I want to build this garage on this lot. This is in October that this conversation is taking place. And he said, oh, he said, that shouldn't be any problem, because I had the garage all drawn out, all the dimensions and everything, size of the lot. He said, shouldn't be any problem. He said, just come down in March or whenever you're going to build. And he says, I'll give you the zoning permit to build it. So, taking people at their word, I took him at his word. I went back in March after I purchased the lot in October, went back in March, talked to him, and he said, oh, no. He says, you can't build that building on that lot. I said, we had this conversation last October. I gave him the date, and he remembered the conversation. He says, no, you can't do that. He says, you can't do that at all. The biggest garage you can build is 24 by 24. And I wanted to build 30 by 50 on a vacant lot. He says, you can't do that. I said, I made a decision based on what you told me, and I assumed that you told me the truth. He said, you must have misunderstood what I told you. I said, I don't think so. So I thought, well, I'm not going to take this lying down. So I thought, well, I'm just going to do something that I've never done before. I'm going to write a letter to the mayor. And so I wrote a letter to the mayor. 3 days later, I get a phone call. I'm in the office early in the morning. The mayor calls me and he says, I understand you're having some trouble. I said, yes, I am. He says, why don't you come down to the office? And he says, I'll have the zoning inspector in here. He says, we'll set up a time and a date. And he says, we'll discuss this situation. So I thought, sure, that sounds reasonable. That's what reasonable men do, right? They sit down and discuss things. So I make the appointment, go down there, sit down. And I thought, after I hung up the phone with him, I thought maybe I should just take the contractor with me who's going to build the building, because he'll know all the specs and all that. So I took him with me. He happened to be the same guy I bought the lot from, see. So we go down there and sit down, and we have this discussion, and the mayor says, well, he said, I understand, you know, what has happened here. And he said, I think this whole thing is a big misunderstanding. And I said, what do you mean by that? And he says, you probably misunderstood what the zoning inspector told you. I said, no. I said, the zoning inspector told me that I could get a permit to build this size of building on this lot now, next March. I said, I had this conversation last October. No, he says, you can't do that. I said, how does that sound to you? I said, if you would have been me and you'd have purchased the lot based on somebody else's statements and then turn around to find out that they were lies, how would you feel about it? He says, I wouldn't feel very good about it at all, but he says, there isn't really anything you can do about this. He says, I suggest if you want to do anything about this, you just take us to court. I thought, okay. I said, all right. So I called up my attorney and I said, where are we going on this? And he says, you're going nowhere. I said, what do you mean? He says, this is a routine practice with the zoning inspector in the city of Findlay. He says, there's been multiple cases just like yours that had already been litigated and they were all lost. He says, you might as well just figure out another avenue to do this. So I said, okay. So I told the contractor, I said, I can't build the building I want. I said, what am I going to do now? And he says, I'll tell you what. He said, if you let me build the building, I will purchase the lot back off of you. He says, and then you can go out and find the land you want the building built on, and I'll build it for you. I said, it's a done deal. So another miracle. God intervened there. Then 1988, from 1996, I began another episode in my life with the Internal Revenue Service. And I'm going to just tell you the highlights of this, but I don't know how much you've ever been on your face before the Lord, petitioning the Lord for a favorable outcome in your life. But I can tell you, and I can probably speak for Rusty, that we spent tons of hours on our face praying that God would exercise His will in this situation and extract us. And I retained an attorney out in Arizona who does nothing but litigate these kind of cases, and he's very good at it, and he's done it for 25 years. And I flew out to Arizona and told him my predicament, and he said, they're going to win. He said, it doesn't matter what you're going to do. He says, they're going to win. He said, so you need to cut your losses and get out of this thing as best you can. So I took his advice, and that was contrary to the advice of two or three other attorneys that had preceded him that told me to go the opposite direction. So I took his advice and tried to get myself out of the situation. As you can see, it took about 8 years for that to happen. But the reason I tell you this story is because when this attorney in Arizona is a Christian, and it was coming time to either settle the case or the case was going to go to court. We were down to the end of the road, so to speak, on the time spectrum. And he called me up and he said, "This is where we're at." He said, "What do you want me to do?" And you know how God kind of puts thoughts in your mind about what you should do when the rubber's trying to meet the road? God said, "Tell him to go into the room with the IRS agent and stay there until you get the case settled." And I said, "That's what you should do." He says, "Well, I've never done that before." I said, "Probably not." But I said, "That's what you should do." So the next day he went into the room with the IRS agent, and they were in there, I think, about 8 or 10 hours. And a normal meeting is 2 hours with an agent. And they were in there 8 to 10 hours, and they actually settled the case, which is favorable to me. It was the best I could do under the circumstances. Now, fast forward about 6 or 7 years after that, I had another scenario with the IRS agent that they weren't going to honor this agreement that they made in 1996. And so I called him back up and we were chatting, and he said, "I did want to share one thing with you." I says, "What's that?" He said, "You remember that request you made a long time ago for me to go into that room with that agent and stay there until you got it settled?" I said, "Yeah, I remember that." He said, "You know," he said, "that's the only time in my entire legal career that's ever happened, ever, that I was ever able to do that." He said, "I don't know how that happened." I said, "I know how it happened." I said, "That whole thing was prepared with prayer." I said, "You know, the higher authorities were being orchestrated by God. That's exactly how that happened. And their mindset was predisposed in that direction. And God stepped in and plugged in all the facts that they needed for that to happen. Another miracle." And then in December 18th of 2008, we lost Tiffany. She was 30 years old and lived far longer than anybody else had ever expected her to live. And I can remember, you know, giving her CPR on the couch before she passed into eternity. But that is a miracle in and of itself, because I'd always prayed that when Tiffany went home to be with the Lord, that there wouldn't be any pain involved, and there wasn't. Now we're going to fast forward to about 2010. In 2010, we had a place up at the lake they were trying to sell. You probably can relate to the real estate market in 2010, which was next to nothing. I told her, I said, "You know, if God wants us to sell this place," I said, "we'll sell it." So I put a sign in the window. Here's my signs again. Put a sign in the window and left that weekend, come back the next weekend, and a guy called me up and he says, we drove through the park during the course of the week." He said, "We saw your sign in the window and we like your mobile home. We want to come up and take a look at it." I said, "Okay." So he comes up on Sunday, takes a walk through it, and he says, "This is exactly what we want." Quibbled a little bit on price, not much, and sealed the deal right there. Another miracle. In 2011, the fall of 2011, 2010, I should say, God started convicting me about selling my practice. Now, this was the furthest thing from my mind. I don't know whether God ever challenges you in ways like that or not. You know, in Jeremiah 33:3, it says, "Call unto me, and I will answer thee, and show thee great and mighty things which thou knowest not." Great and mighty things which thou knowest not. And God is capable of doing great and mighty things which we don't even comprehend can be done, because we're finite. He's infinite. And when we look at a problem or a situation, we look at it with unlimited capability. But His problem-solving solutions are far beyond us. And I could not understand why God was telling me to do that, because I had other plans. My other plans were that I was going to do what's called retire in practice. That's where you work fewer days, you see fewer patients, but you're still in practice. But I thought, no, Lord, you must have made a mistake. You must have made a mistake on this one. Because why would you tell me to do something like that? So I kind of sloughed it off for a little while, 2 or 3 weeks. The Holy Spirit started speaking louder and louder and louder. And I thought, yeah, you can do one of two things. God says in John 14:15, he says, if you love me, obey me. That's what he says. If you love me, obey me. So I thought, maybe I ought to obey. So the University of Findlay, my practice was located on North Main Street, as I said earlier, and the University of Findlay was my neighbor, and they'd been after me for like 12 or 14 years to buy my buildings and my lot there. So I called them up and said, are you still interested? Yep, we're still interested, and we want to buy it. So we sealed the deal, and June 13th of 2011 was my last day in practice. And so the following 2 weeks, we cleaned out all the buildings and everything and hauled everything away, and we actually closed the deal July 1st, and that was the end of that. So then I thought, well, I made a promise to my wife that I'd finish the basement at home, which I had already had about half done, but you know how that is. We built our house in 2000, and I had worked on the basement on and off since 2000, but never had got it quite done. I had the walls up and all the electrical run and so on and so forth, but I had the floor to put down and two ceilings to put up. So I got done last July, took a week off, and then started on the basement routine and spent about 6 weeks finishing that up. Finished the basement, got that all done. And then the pastor says, hey, he says, why don't you go fishing with us? This is last September. And I said, well, I said, that sounds like a little bit of fun. You know, I hadn't done anything all summer. He says, let's go fishing. So we left the dock up there at Catawba, and at 6 in the morning, and started out across the lake, and we went out 12 miles, and there I am out there in the lake, fishing about 8:40, standing up spinning, and I feel this sharp pain running across the top of my chest. It lasted about 10 seconds. It's probably about a 7 on a scale of 1 to 10. And I thought, wow. You know, when you're a physician, as soon as something like that happens, guess what happens? All the wheels start just churning like crazy. You know, you start running the diagnostics on yourself. And nothing was actually adding up in my head. And then after a few minutes, I started feeling these little prickly sensations in my legs. I thought, wow, that's different. I reached down and touched my legs, and I could feel my legs, but they were real prickly. And a few more casts, and then pretty soon I thought, man, my legs are getting weak. So I thought, I think I better sit down. I sat down on the boat seat, and within 3 minutes of sitting down on the boat seat, I could not even wiggle my little toes. It was just gone from here down, just like that, instantaneously. Pastor looked over, and he says, you doing all right? And I said, nope. He said, I'm not doing too good. He says, you want to go in? I said, yeah, you better take me in. So they took me in, and Got in, took about 20, 25 minutes to get back to the boat dock, and two of the other guys on the charter picked me up out of the boat seat and carried me 120 feet down the dock and set me in the pastor's car, and he said, well, Rodney, what do you want to do? I said, well, I think I want to go home. Now, I'll tell you why I said that, because of that guy sitting in the back there, because he always takes care of me. I take care of him. I thought, well, I got a problem. I'll just go home and let him come up and take a look. Pastor says, well, he said, now, let's talk about this a moment. He said, if you had a patient just like you are right now, what would you do with him? I said, well, I'm not a cardiovascular expert, so I'd probably send him to the hospital. He said, do you think you ought to go to the hospital? Well, you know, hospital and me is a foreign thing. I've never been in the hospital in my life, only when I was born. That was it. So here I am, almost 63 years old. I've never been in the hospital. I said, well, I says, that probably would be good. I probably should go to the hospital. Then he says, where do you want to go? And then I remembered my sister, who's a traveling nurse. She had worked up at Magruder Hospital there in Port Clinton. And she said, if you have a problem while you're up here and it's serious, she says, you might as well just go to Toledo. She says, because when all these people come in off the lake that have serious problems, she says, we lifeline them from here right over to Toledo. So I told the pastor, I says, well, just take me to Toledo. So he flips on the blinkers on his car, and we take out across there 100 mile an hour. Pass a highway patrolman and a sheriff's deputy, and they don't pay any attention. We're just streaking by there. On the way over, I started getting the feeling back in my legs. I got almost all of it back in my left leg and about 50% of it in my right leg. Got over there. He called ahead, got the directions to the emergency room, rolled up to the emergency room. Staff come out, bring the gurney out, pick me up out of the car seat. And as soon as they picked me up, I lost all this again, just like that. Put me on the gurney, wheeled me in, and you probably know the rest of the story. They ran four EKGs. Those were all negative. Did a CAT or an MRI of the thoracic spine, lumbar spine. That was all negative. Did a CAT scan of the abdominal cavity. That was all negative. And then I got a visit from the neurosurgeon. He comes down and he looks at me and he says, well, he says, I think you've suffered a spinal cord stroke. And I thought, a spinal cord stroke? And he says, yeah. He says, I get two cases like this a year, just like yours. And he says, the unfortunate thing about this is that they never get their faculties back. Whatever they've lost, they never get back. But he says, I think you're going to get yours back. He says, because you still have reflexes in your knees and your ankles. I thought, well, that's encouraging. That is. It was encouraging when I couldn't move my feet. So they said, we're going to admit you. So they admitted me and wheeled me up to the fifth floor, the neuroscience floor, and the rest of the day was uneventful. I ate supper, felt good, slept all night, felt good, got up the next morning, ate breakfast, felt good, ate lunch, felt good, and then about that afternoon, about 2 o'clock, I started getting a little chest pain across here, maybe 2, 3. And about 2:30, it was up to about 6 or 7. The nurse came in, and she said, are you having any pain? She'd been asking this routinely, you know, since I was admitted. And I said, yes, I am having some pain. She said, well, let me get you some medication. So she went out and got some medication. They gave me the medication, and it took all the pain away for 15 minutes. She came back, and she said, are you in pain again? I said, yes. I said, I'm lots of pain. She said, well, I can't give any more medication because you have to wait, you know, so long between each dose. She said, let me call the cardiologist to see what he wants to do. She calls the cardiologist and he says, well, let's bring him down to the diagnostics center and run an ultrasound on his heart. The diagnostics center, I was in St. V's Hospital in Toledo. The diagnostics center was a quarter mile from my room. So they said, we'll send up an assistant to bring you down. So they send up the assistant who never came. So I'm in the room and the pain's getting slowly worse. So about 45 minutes later, the pain's probably about a 7, 8. And the nurse that's taking care of me comes in and says, she says, I can't wait any longer. And she says, I don't think you can either. I'm going to just take you down there myself. So no sooner than she had said that than the other gal that was supposed to come around the corner, pick me up, started pushing me down there. So Vicky's following along. We're going along a pretty good clip. We get it down there, and we're about 20 feet from the entrance to the diagnostic unit. And the pain just went crazy in my chest and went off the map, and I passed out. And so unbeknownst to me or her at that point in time, just inside the doors was the code unit, and they were in a seminar all together in one room. So as soon as I went passed out, she screamed. Code unit came running out, grabbed me, pushed me into the room. Then I woke up. There's a nurse right here, nurse right here. Stay awake, don't go anywhere. Stay awake, stay awake, stay awake. Hear all these nurses talking back and forth. We don't know what's wrong with this guy. We don't know what's wrong with this guy. What should we do? Who should we call? Well, you can't call any cardiovascular people because they already did their operations this morning. And they all left. You mean there's nobody here? Nobody here. About this time, another guy comes strolling in and the nurses gyrate over to him. And he's a cardiologist. And they say, we don't know what's wrong with him. We don't know what's wrong with him. And he walks over, looks, and he says, he's got an internal bleed, and he needs immediate surgery. Well, there's nobody to operate on him. They all left this morning. He said, I can't help you. He said, that's what's wrong. And that's what needs to be done. So they call, and they finally catch one guy going out the door. So he comes down, and the nurses give me the gas. And the next thing I know, I'm waking up the following day. And the story's all over. The cardiovascular surgeon said I had about 15 minutes. If they wouldn't have did anything in the next 15 minutes, I wouldn't be here. So he tells me the following morning in recovery, he says, we opened up your chest. He said everything looked fine in there. The heart was fine. He said there wasn't any plaquing in the heart, no plaquing in the arteries, none of that. He said, but we found a hole in your aorta. He said, you were bleeding internally for the time when I was out in the boat, got the chest pain, which is over 30 hours. He said, you were bleeding internally that time. He says, when we opened you up, you had a blood clot about the size of the placenta right over the hole in the aorta. He says, that's what was keeping you alive during that particular point in time. So he said, we removed that, we repaired the hole. He said, you should never have any more problems with it in your whole life. Miracles. Now, when you think about your own life and you sit down and think about what God has done, I'm sure you can come up with miracles like this. But the thing that I want to leave you with is that we serve a God that loves us. And in the book of Jeremiah, it tells us that he says that he has our best interests in mind. And that's very true. He does have our best interests in mind if we'll just allow him to take care of those needs. You know, oftentimes we want to get in the driver's seat and we want to push the agenda. We don't want to sit back and wait. You know, we are an instant culture. We have to have everything yesterday. But that's not the way God works. And God is taking every one of you to school. And just like he took me to school over these 60 years, and the school is still in session for me. It's in session for everybody, but his whole goal is to conform you and I to the image of his son Jesus, to make us usable in the kingdom. And that's what he wants out of us. Those are miracles. So that's what I have to say about miracles and my relationship to God and my own testimony.